Hey everyone, it's Matt Katz with you on The Takeaway. Tanzina's a little under the weather, so it's me and you all hour. Over the weekend, uprisings against police brutality and racism continued throughout the country. Tens of thousands of demonstrators turned out to demand justice for George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and the myriad black people who have been killed in the U.S. And there are now some signs of change. The Minneapolis City Council says they plan to vote to dismantle their police department in favor of a new system. And here in New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio announced he'd be shifting funds away from the NYPD to other social services. Lots of places are seeing immediate change like this. But the protests also stretched far beyond American borders. Thousands of people turned out in cities including London, Berlin, Sydney, Tokyo, many foreign leaders have also condemned the killing of George Floyd, including British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who himself has a history of racist rhetoric.
We mourn George Floyd, and I was appalled and sickened to see what happened to him. And my message to President Trump, to everybody in the United States from the UK, is that I don't think racism or race, and it's an opinion that I'm sure is shared by the overwhelming majority of people around the world. Racism, racist violence has no place in our society.
But demonstrators outside of the U.S. are also attempting to turn the lens inward and call attention to racial injustice within their own borders. And whether officials abroad are actually listening to those messages or just pointing fingers at the U.S., that's where we're going to start today. Joining me now is Robin Wright, a Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow and a columnist at The New Yorker. Thanks for coming back in The Takeaway, Robin.
Always good to be with you.
And also with us is Yasmin Abdelmajid, a writer and broadcaster based in London. Welcome to the show, Yasmin.
Thank you so much for having me, Matt.
So Yasmin, you're in London. What did demonstrations there look like over the weekend?
So demonstrations here in London started even on Wednesday, and they've sort of been building various cities around the UK, kind of culminating over the weekend. And I, as my voice is testament to, was at some of the protests on the weekend. Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, there was a sense of hopeful change and a sense that perhaps this is a moment, unlike other moments we've seen before. They were quite peaceful. And I know that there was some reporting of violence and so on, especially in London. But by and large, it was incredibly peaceful. It was incredibly focused. It was partly to do with what was going on in the US, and you know, we spoke the names of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and others, but also, as you mentioned, focused on what happens here in the UK and the systemic discrimination and the police brutality that exists here in the UK. And so there's this real push for people to not only just look at what's going on across the ocean, but to focus within, and that's been pretty incredible to see.
So what kind of issues in the UK? Yasmin, you spoke of your hoarse voice. What sort of chants were you chanting? Were you saying George Floyd's name and Black Lives Matter, but also some more specific messages aimed at issues in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, it started from George Floyd and Black Lives Matter and no justice, no peace, no racist police, to speaking the names of folks who have lost lives to police brutality here in the UK, whether that's Mark Duggan or Sean Rigg or Shegu Bayer. And also, it's not as big a movement yet, but it's definitely something that started to take shape in the UK. The concept of defunding the police, the concept of prison abolition, these are concepts that even a couple of weeks ago, to be fairly honest, as someone who's been in this space for a long time, they have been more kind of radical thoughts, but they have been brought into the mainstream. And also being the United Kingdom, there was talk around what does it mean for us to be in this post-colonial place? I mean, you may have seen reports of the statue of Edward Colston, who was a massive slave trader, who has a statue in Bristol, and the statue was taken down and thrown into the river. And so following on from the sort of in the same vein of the Roads Must Fall campaign that raised its head a few years ago, that's now become a part of this movement as well. And yes, that shifts slightly from the police brutality focus, but it is also about the UK and Britain grappling with and recognizing, hopefully, some of its history and the fact that the racism that exists, you know, in the US found its home almost, or its grandparent, if you will, is the UK, is Britain, because that's where the concept of race was initially formalized. And so it is definitely it's taking shape in lots of different ways.
Robin, you noted in an article last week that many of the signs being carried by protesters abroad are actually in English, even in countries where English is not the main language. Why do you think that messaging is significant?
When the first protest began overseas, it was clear that the focus was on the United States. And it was standing up not just to the issue of racism, but to the issue of domination by the United States in terms of whether it's moral rights or military might. And it was a pushback that reflected a lot of things that have happened over the last 20 years in terms of where America has exerted its influence throughout the region, trying to create the American model, whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan and elsewhere. But there were also the symbols and the fact that in Britain or in Germany, where the first soccer league opened in Europe, that at one of the big matches, the two players who scored took a knee. And this is a symbol that Colin Kaepernick, who is a 49ers quarterback who made the knee famous, that these are American symbols and that America has defined this issue, but it has also defined the symbols. And so this is the world saying back to the United States, you know, don't preach to us. Do what you say you want us to do. But I also think it does play out and it has grown over the last week so that it does reflect messages to their own governments. And this is what's so striking, that on six continents, you now have movements where people are challenging the legacies of the 20th century. This is a 21st century movement taking on the themes of the 21st, whether it's the end of colonialism and making countries independent, but still subservient to kind of the white world, and playing out on immigration issues, that this issue over George Floyd has deepened as it has grown and takes on what is now very 21st century issues.
It's interesting, Raman. Officials from countries that are U.S. allies and then also leaders from countries that are on far less friendly terms with the U.S. have roundly condemned the killing of George Floyd. Is that unusual? Do foreign leaders normally speak out on specific cases like this? Or do you think they're perhaps taking what they're hearing from the protests in their own countries and turning that around with public condemnations against the United States and United States policy?
There's no question that leaders throughout the world feel the pressure of these movements, and there is a message to them as well. I think the thing that struck me the most was that the European Union, which is a group of almost 30 countries that we have helped form to prevent war in Europe, again, came out with a statement that normally is reserved for dictators. It said it looked forward to all the resolution of all issues with full respect for the rule of law and human rights. And so that was a kind of message that resonated among their own constituents, but I think reflected this, you know, shaming of the United States and particularly of President Trump over the way this issue has exploded across American cities.
Yasmin, you live in the UK, you grew up in Australia, both places had major protests this weekend. What is policing in Black communities and in the UK look like, and then Indigenous communities in Australia look like?
Yeah, so I'll start with Australia. And I think for context, the Australian Indigenous population or communities also refer to themselves as Black. And so when we talk about policing Black communities in Australia, quite a lot of that is also the relationship between Australian sort of broadly white police, settler police, and the First Nations populations. And I mean, it's so comparable to the United States. There are police deaths in custody. I think there's been over 400 deaths in custody since 91. And interestingly, more police have been promoted after a death in custody than have actually been charged or convicted for any sort of crime.
Wow.
And the incarceration rates, I mean, I think it's about, in Northern Territory, for example, which is one of the states of Australia, I think population of young people in detention are Indigenous. And there's only about 3.3% of the Australian population is Indigenous, and 28% of the population of those who are incarcerated are Indigenous. And even when there were protests this weekend, hundreds of thousands of people across Australia came out, there was a death in custody during the same time that the protests were going on. And so it's been something that Indigenous communities and Aboriginal communities have been speaking about for decades. The other context I'll give is that the way that Australia was founded was that when the British came, they declared Australia terra nullius, which essentially means they did not have to sign any treaties with the Indigenous population because they deemed the country uninhabited. And any Indigenous people, they tried to kill all the Indigenous people, but any left, they were then wards of the state. And so similarly with the United States, we have a very brutal history between the black communities and the police. Similarly in Australia, you have that with the Indigenous people and the police. The UK, the history of the police is different, but definitely analogous. And the other thing that I always point out with the Brits is they offshored the worst of their racist brutality. That was what the empire was about. And so often people are like, oh, you know, we don't have the kind of racism here. We don't have the kind of police brutality here in the UK that, you know, you might see in the US or you might see in Australia. But firstly, as I always remind them, it came from the UK, came from Britain. But also, when you look at things like Grenfell, which was this building full of social housing that was set on fire, essentially, and almost like hundreds of folks died, and it was awful, and it was in one of the wealthiest areas of London. And there's been sort of no change since then. Or if you look at the Windrush generation, so the Brits after the war asked for folks from the Caribbean communities to come to the UK to help them rebuild. And they said, oh, you know, you're British citizens, it's all fine. And then they lost, quote unquote, the citizenship paperwork. And so the way that the Brits do their racism, so to speak, is maybe not as blatant, but it's exceptionally racist. And the way that it's baked into all of the institutions makes it almost more difficult to point to because it's so part of the norm.
Yasmin, you wrote something interesting in Time magazine that you think the pandemic and the fact that much of the world has been locked down for months has somehow given people worldwide the space to focus their attention on this issue in a new way. Am I characterizing that right?
Definitely. I think we cannot divorce this moment from the context in which it appears, which is that we are still in the midst of a global pandemic where millions of us have been forced to stay in our houses in a way that has never happened in our lifetimes. And so it's put a pause on so much, on our social lives, on economic activity, but also it has meant that we have this space to focus on things in ways that we have never had before as a collective. And we are so online, like particularly in English-speaking Western countries, so many of us are working online and socializing online. And therefore, when you see all these conversations around Black Lives Matter and George Floyd's, the video of his murder being circulated, this was not something you could switch off from. There was nowhere for you to go. There was nowhere else to look. And the other thing I think is really interesting is that people had the experience of being at the mercy of a system for the first time. A lot of people, the idea of systemic racism or structural racism is nebulous. It's not super easy to understand, right? But if all of a sudden you're forced to do stuff or you're treated in a way that is not about you as an individual, but is about you as part of a collective, and actually the system is not serving you, it's failing you. Here in the UK, we've had over 50,000 deaths because of coronavirus. And that's effectively because of the failure of governance. In the US, similarly, there's been failure of governance, and people are saying, hey, this system is supposed to protect me. Is this what it feels like to be failed by a system? And then that gives people a bit of a framework to think, oh, maybe their systems are failing other people. Maybe this is what it means when people talk about different systems. There's possibility now to talk about things in a way that didn't exist before. And if I can also add one more thing, we are in an era of the rise of the right wing in a way that I haven't seen in my lifetime, right? The rhetoric that's come from not only leaders in the United States, but in the UK and Australia and so on, is unprecedented, really, for the last, 20, 30 years. And so you've got folks who have felt like they're slipping backwards, have felt like rights are being slowly taken away. And this is a moment where all of that sort of repressed frustration and disillusionment and disempowerment, I think, has coalesced into something much more powerful.
So something revolutionary, perhaps. We've seen symbols of slavery and colonialism targeted in these protests around the world. Statues of Belgium's King Leopold II, who left a murderous legacy in Congo, were vandalized throughout Belgium. The statue of a 17th century slave trader in Bristol, England, which we mentioned earlier, was tossed into the sea. Robin, you've covered a number of protest movements around the world through the years. What do you see as the historical connections that people are making here between these older symbols and then the outrage of this very current killing of George Floyd?
Well, it is in many ways a protest against the past. And this is, as I said, the reaction to colonialism and the legacy of racism that followed. I was in Soweto in June 1976 when the first black mass uprising began against apartheid, and was there for as it unfolded for over the next 18 months. And of course, it changed a system. But it took 15 years before Nelson Mandela walked to freedom, and I went back to watch that as well. And for all the hope and the momentum of the moment, the fact is it's going to take a long time to get to a place where there is fundamental change that addresses fully and equitably the kinds of demands that these protesters have, and that's the frustration. And the danger of some kind of instability or the lack of connection in the meantime. We can all hope that this moves us along, but the course of history shows that even with the help of social media, it can take time to get to a place that produces significant and enduring change.
Robin Wright is a Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow and a columnist at The New Yorker. And Yasmin Abdel-Majid is a writer and broadcaster based in London. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.